Thank you, everyone, for being here for this first meeting of the Emergency Elections Planning Task Force. I really appreciate everyone's participation. It's a pleasure to have you. There's some familiar faces here, some a little bit less so, but we'll all get to know one another. And I really appreciate you being here for what I think will be an important series of conversations on an important issue. I want to thank the legislators here in particular, who will later introduce themselves, for helping put this together. All of them have been and are active on elections issues, and I really appreciate that. I know Senator Sieben spent a great deal of time and energy on her own in making sure this made it into this year's omnibus elections bill, and with good reason. It's obviously a big issue. Many of you know, as I think at least one of our presenters will repeat here today, that the issue of emergency preparedness really came to the fore most recently probably with Hurricane Sandy in the 2012 general election. It was a presidential year, as you know, and on the East Coast, particularly in New York and New Jersey, there was real concern when the storm hit, which was just almost on the eve of election, that there would be a disruption of that election. And it called into question the extent to which states, including Minnesota, had laws on the books that would prepare citizens and prepare voters for the eventuality of a problem. So we're here so that Minnesota can take its place among states that since that time have really prepared for disasters of all kinds, not just natural disasters, but others. Now, we're not in danger of a hurricane here in Minnesota, obviously, but we have had weather emergencies like the famous Halloween snowstorm of 1991, which dumped something like 28 inches of snow in a very short period of time on much of Minnesota. But even apart from weather, there's always the chance that there are other emergencies, power outages, epidemics, God forbid, a national security emergency, or terrorism, or something of that nature. So we have to be prepared, and I think we're going to have a lot of great presenters today and in the future who will tell us, give us some guidance as to how we might do that. One of the things that is exciting to me about this process is it fills in some of the gaps in terms of the legislature's work. The legislature's work, obviously, very important, but given our citizen legislature, committee hearings are often a time to hear bills, mostly, and there's not a lot of time, typically, to do the kind of work that we're going to do today, which is to explore an issue in depth without a bill before us, without amendments before us, without anything necessarily to vote on, but just really explore the issue. So that's what we're going to be doing here today. Before I get to introductions, I want to thank Sally Olson. Sally, can you identify yourself? Oh, there she is. Sally from the Legislative Coordinating Commission for coordinating all of this. I just want to make sure everyone knows who Sally is. She's the one who's really making the trains run on time here, at the very least. She's doing much more than just that. I just want to remind everyone, per the request of the LCC, you'll see in your packets there's an oath of office. Please remember, if you can today, to fill that out. Simply sign it and return it to Sally by the time you leave here today. That's a prerequisite for continued service on this in this body. So we really appreciate that. I think at this point it's probably a good and healthy thing just to do a round of introductions. And I would invite everyone not only around the table, whether you're a formal official member of this task force or not, but also those who wish to identify themselves, who are guests here today and are sitting in the audience, can. You don't need to. Any citizen is welcome here. It's open to the public, and it's not a requirement that you identify yourself or who you're with, but if you care to, I think that would be helpful as well. Sally, do you want to just start? And I would ask that folks identify themselves, who, if anyone, they're representing. And then if you could, just for a second, say a little bit about what you think that we as a group ought to be getting out of this process, if you care to.
Me? You want me to tell you that? I'm just supposed to provide administrative support. Yeah, I'm Sally Olson. I work with the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and our office will be providing staff assistance to help the meetings run. I'm not quite sure what to expect you should get out of this process, but I expect I'll learn something as well. So,
thank you.
Well, hi, I'm Major Taylor Cox. I am a domestic operations exercise planner for the state. So I'm representing Major General Rick Nash as his the Adjutant General as his designee. What I expect to get out of this is a perhaps a better understanding of what emergencies consist of and how they're responded to, and obviously what support the if any the National Guard can provide to that process.
My name is Barrett Lane. I'm the Emergency Management Director at the City of Minneapolis. I'm here on behalf of AMEM, the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers, and I think the best thing we could do here is come up with a concept of operations for how we would want to see, from a threat hazard risk assessment, from a capabilities assessment, how we want to make sure that we can continue the services of our elections activities on an all-hazards basis. So, whatever they throw at us, we want to make sure that we can preserve that capability in the face of those challenges. So it's about resilience in the electoral system.
Kevin Luer with the State of Minnesota Department of Public Safety, Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. I'm the director of our preparedness branch. I'm here representing Director Joe Kelly from Homeland Security and Emergency Management. One of my missions for the state is to oversee the state's emergency operations plan. So I guess one of the outcomes of this would be looking at the state's response strategy overall, which doesn't really clearly address election-related issues, of how we would incorporate that into the state's emergency operations plan and how that would integrate with other agencies and agency support in that process. We also, as the Department of Public Safety, are the newly assigned coordinator for continuity planning across state government as well under Executive Order 1514. And so trying to figure out how we help and how we integrate this planning continuity effort for elections into the state's overall continuity of operations and continuity of government planning.
Thank you.
I'm Senator Mary Hifmeyer, and I look forward to serving on this, but probably out of all of you, as Secretary of State, I was in office on 9/11. So that was an election day here in Minnesota. I suspect there's a few around the table here that were also working that day on an election day. And to let you know, we proceeded with that election, got through. But I also remember meeting in DPS in a very secret spot with Governor Ventura and Attorney General Mike Hatch and so on to make preparations should we need to go somewhere very quickly. And your office conducted itself and did a very, very good job. And so I probably have one of the most major experiences of anyone standing in a polling place on Election Day, watching a TV off to the side, seeing the second airplane hit, and knowing that, matter of fact, that we were in a unique situation unlike we'd ever experienced before. So I look forward to being a member of this. I'm also very cautious about elections are unlike any other emergency activity. So it is unique, and I look forward to being a member to contribute in any way I can.
I'm Representative Kelly Fenton, and I serve House District 53B, which is in Woodbury. And I also currently serve on the Elections Committee, and it's an honor to be a part of this as well. Some things that I hope to get out of this is just identifying the needs and emergencies and implementing a plan, and I think it's always best to be over-prepared and hope that we never have to put the plan in place. So thank you.
I'm Steve Simon. I'm Secretary of State, and I'm pleased to be part of this group. Obviously, this is really important stuff, and as I think you're going to hear today, I think what we need, at least from my standpoint, is more rules of the road. I think there are a lot of people who might not understand what would happen in case of an emergency, either weather-related or other, and we just need to make sure at the end of this process, my hope is that we have a lot more clarity about who makes the decisions, what the range of decisions are, and how best to effectuate a good result, which is that people can still vote and still cast their ballot. So that, to me, is the most important, and I'm really excited to get to work with all of you.
I'm Ann Kanaroth, and I'm the deputy to the secretary, and I'm glad to be here today.
I'm Debbie Erickson. I'm the Crow Wing County Auditor-Treasurer, and I'm representing the Minnesota Association of County Officers. And as the election officials for the counties, I think one of our biggest takeaways that we're hoping to get is some standard procedures of understanding what an emergency is, how it occurs, and how we're going to handle it from an administrative standpoint.
My name is Barbara Pruitt, and I am here on behalf of the Stillwater Area Public Schools, appointed by the Minnesota School Boards Association. Looking forward to the work, and I guess I would concur with Debbie that looking for practical practices that we could put into place should the event arise.
I'm Lucinda Messman, and I'm here representing Minnesota Association of Townships, and I would agree getting the proper procedures, but also being able to communicate to the townships how to realistically implement these procedures to the clerks who are running the township elections.
My name is Grace Wachler-Rowitz, and I'm the Director of Elections and Voter Services for the City of Minneapolis, and I'm representing the League of Minnesota Cities. I concur with my colleagues, and I just wanted to add the point that I want to drill it down to the precinct level, that we have the proper protocols and procedures so that the election judges and the polls know how to handle any type of emergency situation, whether it is a statewide or a local situation, that they know what resources and what protocols to follow.
Gary Poser, I'm the Director of Elections for the Secretary of State's office, and I'm here as the designee representing the Elections Division of the office. I would, as an election official as well, I look forward to having some good guidance as to what should be done in any emergency. The more guidance we have, the quicker the response can be and the quicker the situations can be handled. And obviously, I'd also like to avoid us being dragged into court on any of those things. So the more guidance we have, the better.
And I'm Julie Strother. I do government relations with the Office of the Secretary of State. I am really looking forward to having sort of the folks who've spent a lot of time thinking about elections issues and how to run elections well at the table, along with folks who spent a lot of time thinking about how to deal with emergencies and unique situations, and getting sort of the two groups together to come up with some solutions for Minnesota.
Hi, I'm Katie Sieben. I'm the state senator, and I chair the election subcommittee in the Senate. And just by way of a little bit of background, at some point, I got a memo from our council, our Senate council, who works on election issues, and she had been reading the Presidential Commission on Election Administration report. In that, it recommended that there be that states look at their emergency response preparations for election administration. And so she wrote me this great memo that said some of the issues that we had in Minnesota law and where the statute could be clarified. And after talking with Julie and other people in the Secretary of State's office, we thought it would be best to have a task force like this work on it, on recommendations for the upcoming legislature, so that we could find more consensus and have a hopefully a bipartisan package that's supported by members on in both bodies on both sides of the aisle, so that we could have a longer process to work through some of these different issues and put forth ideas. So I look forward to that. Thank you.
I hope my voice carries. Margot M. DeCross, I'm with the Minnesota State Council on Disability. I'm their accessibility specialist, and I'm here at the table today to bring the issues and concerns of the disability community and the many of the senior community to an ever-increasing population.
Okay. Why don't we, and we might not have to do this every meeting, but I think for this first one it's appropriate, for those who care to and wish to in the audience, who introduce themselves. Jim, I'm going to pick on you.
Jim Geldman, House Deputy of Caucus Research. Bert Black, and I've been a legal advisor to Secretary Kiffmeyer, Secretary Ritchie, and Secretary Simon, and I'll simply echo Gary Poser's comments about wanting to avoid being dragged into court.
I'm Mary McFly. I work for the Minnesota Newspaper.
I'm
Jan
Studio.
Anyone else here who wishes to introduce themselves?
I'm Abby Loesch. I'm with Republican Research. Amanda Tinsley, Committee Administrator for Government Operations.
Okay.
Yes,
on this side.
Lexi Strangel, I'm at the Elections Committee of the Senate Council.
And she wrote that great memo I was talking about.
No pressure.
John Milhoff, I'm with the National Association of Secretaries of State, and I'll be presenting towards the end of the
day. Okay, well, thank you all for attending and being part of this process and whatever role you play. Our next item on the agenda is the election of a chair and vice chair. So I'll entertain nominations right now for the chair of this task force. Ms. Erickson.
I would like to nominate Secretary Simon as chair.
Okay, any second to the nomination?
Second. I'll second it.
Okay. There's been a nomination and a second. Any other nominations? Any other nominations? Any other nominations? Okay, seeing none, all in favor of the nomination, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Okay, thank you very much for the honor of chairing this. I'll now entertain nominations for the vice chair of this task force. Are there any nominations for vice chair?
I would like to nominate Debbie Erickson as vice chair.
Okay. Ms. Erickson has been nominated. Is there a second to the nomination?
I'll second.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded. Are there any other nominations for the position of vice chair? Any other nominations? Any other nominations? Okay. Nominations will be closed. All in favor of the sole nominee, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Okay. The motion prevails. Ms. Erickson will be the vice chair. The next item of business is just to review the legislation and the task force's charge. I think this is in your packet. And, again, as Senator Sieben said, and, Senator, I said before you came in that you deserve, a lot of the credit for this, for pushing this, and we really appreciate it. But in what you and others drafted and helped pass, you know, it's pretty straightforward what our charge is and what our task is here. The legislation requires, as you'll see in your materials, that the committee examine potential emergency scenarios that could impact elections, a current capacity and authority to address emergency situations, potential direct and indirect costs of an emergency that disrupts elections, maintaining ballot security in event of an emergency, continuity of operations procedures, and communications plans and key emergency contacts. The legislation also requires that the task force report to the legislature on January 1st, 2016, no later than that date. The report, our report, must include a summary of the committee's findings, recommendations for the development of elections emergency plans statewide, and draft legislation to implement any recommendations of the task force. And on this point, I just want to be clear that not everything that we recommend needs to be a bill. Not everything requires legislation. As many of you know from personal experience or observation, not everything needs to be a bill. Some things require legislation. Other things just don't. So that will be in our collective judgment what we think demands or requires a bill and what can be done without getting the legislature necessarily involved with the bill. But it can be a bill, and to that extent, we should have drafts of that bill or those bills. Any questions on just what our task is? What our mission is here. Okay. Well, it's in the statute at Chapter 70 of the Session Laws, Section 61. I think that kind of raw material is attached for you, but I just wanted to make that point about legislation versus other solutions. Next, I thought that we'd go over a proposed work plan and meeting schedule. Now, this is a proposal, and nothing is set in stone, and if the collective wisdom of this group is that we need to detour either now or as we go along, because after all, it may be that we want to linger longer on a particular subject, or the opposite may be true. There may be a subject that we don't think merits an entire meeting. So I just wanted to walk through very briefly what you have in front of you, kind of a general template or current plan. We're not going to take any sort of vote or anything on that, but this is at least what's before us right now in the general plan. And I'd like both now and after our two presentations today, and even after we adjourn today, to hear from those of you who have modifications or suggestions or proposed detours or change of order or anything. This is a starting place, not necessarily the ending place. So the first meeting is today, obviously, and you can see for yourself what the agenda is today. The idea here, though, is to have several meetings, including the possibility of two in October, as you'll see. The one in August next month would be about reviewing potential scenarios that could impact elections, reviewing state authority. We'll hear a little bit of that today, but talking in a little bit more depth about state authority to address emergency situations generally. Also looking at scenarios addressed by other states. I think it's very useful and helpful, as we'll hear from the representative from NAS today. Meeting three, at least tentatively, would be in September. There we would address or examine our current capacity to address emergency situations, examine issues impacting the disability and senior communities in particular, evaluate potential direct and indirect costs of an emergency that disrupts elections. That language is taken directly from the statute, so we must at some point follow up on that issue. And then meetings four and five, again, all subject to our collective change or decision to go in a different direction, would be an overview of the need for continuity of operations, examination of unique needs for continuity of operations procedures related to elections, evaluate options for maintaining ballot security. Again, that's directly from the statute that we must cover at some point. Reviewing key emergency contacts and model communications plans, and we have a lot of expertise at this table and away from here on those issues. And then the idea for meeting six, which would be in November, would be to kind of synthesize everything we've discussed and kind of the beginnings of putting together our report or some sort of draft. And we discuss and adopt, hopefully at that meeting, certain task force recommendations. And then by meeting seven, presumably the last one before a report is issued, review and approve a final report and recommendations. Now, we could decide, either today or later, to add to this. We could decide to reduce it. So, again, this is a starting place, not an ending place. I think the best thing to do here is to generally operate by consensus. I think we're going to all feel more comfortable that way. So I'm certainly not asking for any vote right now. I don't think that's really necessary. But I'm wondering if, at this moment, anyone has thoughts about this tentative game plan, so to speak. And this won't be the only thing. I'll ask the same question after our two presenters present. And I realize, as is always the case, some people are more comfortable or less comfortable voicing concerns or ideas in meetings like this. Others prefer to do it offline. The only thing I would say about doing it offline is please be mindful, as the LCC knows, that we are subject to the open meeting law here. So although you will be getting at some point a list of contact information for everyone here, we are subject to state law, and that means we are not to send out emails to only one another in a mass sort of way, because that violates the open meeting law. But if it's one-on-one and within reason, obviously we can talk to one another on a limited basis outside of this room. But please be mindful of the open meeting law. But my general point before having gone into that kind of bit of legalese is that generally, you know, some of you may wish to share your ideas and thoughts today. Some of you might want to sleep on it and get back to me or to Ms. Olson or to Ann Kane or Roth or others tomorrow or next week or as we go. But this is a starting place, not an ending place. Any thoughts at this moment about this proposed game plan? Any thoughts? Okay. Well, again, feel free at any time, online or offline, to let us know what you think about that. I think next, why don't we go into an overview of current status of Minnesota laws.
In other words, Secretary Simon, would you like me to go up to the table?
Yes, could you? I think that would be helpful. So Julie Strother from the Office of Secretary of State, aided during any Q&A by Gary Poser,
yes,
of the Secretary of State's office, will just give you a little overview about what the current rules of the road are, what exists, and probably more so, what doesn't exist. So Ms. Strother, thank you.
Yeah, Secretary Simon did ask me to give a brief overview of the current laws governing elections. I would say that governing emergencies and elections, I should say, for the election administrators at the table, you should feel free to jump in if you think I'm missing something or you'd like to elaborate. And otherwise, please feel free to ask questions. But the presentation is pretty short, in part because, you know, we have very few laws that provide any authority in the case of an emergency surrounding an election. So there is a PowerPoint, I believe, in your materials, mostly to use as a reference for the statutory sites. But as you can see, there are basically three places in our law where we deal with emergencies and elections. The first deals with election judge vacancies, and that's really for an election judge vacancy on election day. The second is an issue at an individual polling place. And the third, which is broader but is only for non-statewide local elections, is the ability to postpone an election. So I'll go through each of those individually. First is the piece about election judges. Minnesota law does allow for the filling of an election judge vacancy on the spot. Essentially, if an election judge doesn't show up at the polling place, the head election judge, in conjunction with the other judges that are there, can pull someone from the line who they know would be a good election judge. There's a procedure for providing emergency training, and then that person can serve as an election judge on election day. But that really is designed for one or two election judges who are out because of an unexpected illness. It doesn't necessarily address an issue where, you know, a large number of election judges are ill or people can't get to the polling place. So it doesn't address that, but it does address the individual situation. The other piece of flexibility in election laws relating to statewide election is the ability to move a polling place on election day if it becomes unusable. So, you know, if there is no power in the polling place on election day, the They have the ability to move the polling place, but that ability is pretty limited. It must be within the precinct still or within a mile of the precinct. The building must be ADA compliant. But that doesn't provide us with the authority to, say, consolidate some polling places together if there's a need, or move polling places to the county seat if a certain area of the county is inaccessible. So it does provide some authority, but, again, it's a pretty case-by-case designed for the limited circumstances where the power is out or there's a water leak in the building. And then finally, probably, the biggest tool is the ability to postpone an election. But that ability is only in a local election that's not held in conjunction with a statewide general election. So municipalities can postpone an election. Towns in their March Township meeting can postpone an election. But that ability is also limited only to weather-related needs. So if there is hazardous weather that they determine would cause issues with voters getting to the poll, then they can postpone it, but they can't postpone it for any other reason. So those are really the three places in election law where we address emergencies, which is not a lot.
Julie, can I just add one thing? Mm-hmm. With the March Township one, there is already a date in statute that states what they can postpone to. Mm-hmm. And
right. We can postpone it to the following week, mm-hmm. or there, yeah.
But there's nothing for any other types of elections that already has a specific date. Mm-hmm. It's just the township elections where it's noted that way.
And it's 1 week postpone, and the township clerk as the head election official makes the call on the weather.
And it's specifically related to the weather, yeah. Not for any
very
kind
specifically.
Of emergency.
Oh, and Debbie, can I say, but doesn't the postponing one say that it would be the following Tuesday?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, yep. I mean, the township one specifically says the next
right.
week, but I think, if somebody had a special election on a Thursday,
it could be.
By statute, the postponement goes to the next Tuesday.
To the next Tuesday, yeah.
Got it.
Question I have?
Yes.
I was just wondering, how many times has that been used? Do you have any information on, has it ever been used, or how often, or how it worked?
I don't right now, but I can find out. Do you have any?
I do know, Mr. Chair, that there were a few times not that long ago, probably within the last 5 years, there was some weather issues on a March date that I know in Crow Wing County we had a few townships that actually took advantage and did move their election, and I'm assuming there were others throughout the state at that time. Mm-hmm. It's been probably within the last 5 years the last time that I think that it's been invoked, but it has been done.
Right. In fact, I believe within the last 5 years is what prompted the additional language allowing the postponement of the county and school district elections as well, because it was on the March election day, and up in northwestern Minnesota they had that blizzard, so there were a lot of townships in the Crookston area that were postponing elections. But there was a specific county that had a special county commissioner election, and they couldn't, the townships that were involved in that wanted to postpone, but they couldn't because nothing allowed the county commissioner election to be postponed, and that's what prompted the current law that we have.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes,
Senator. I think it'd be really important, if possible, to have them come and testify to us. I'd like to hear from them directly how it worked, how they implemented it, because I think there's nothing better than having somebody who actually had an experience and dealt with that, and I think it'd be very helpful to hear from them.
Senator Kiffmeyer, do you mean to say a person in the township who basically made the call or to postpone?
Well, somebody who can speak on behalf of that township, sometimes they're there yet, not there yet, but somebody who maybe had direct experience with it and can represent. Maybe they aren't the actual person, they can't come, I don't know, but somebody who has direct knowledge of it, I think, would be helpful.
That's a very good idea, and maybe we can talk offline a little bit about getting someone who can maybe appear before us, who in recent years had this experience. That's a great insight. I appreciate that. Go ahead, Julie.
Well, so that was my summary of the election laws, but I did just want to note that, those election laws deal with limited occurrences, and then the postponement, again, doesn't deal with the state general election. Secretary Simon sort of previewed, the things that we know can happen around Election Day in Minnesota, the most obvious being a snowstorm. We had the Halloween blizzard. Gary mentioned that there was an Armistice Day blizzard in 1940, right, that happened on November 11th. But we've really been lucky that we haven't had something like that on Election Day recently. But we don't have anything or plan in place to deal with that type of incident right now. We also, I think, don't have anything in procedures or in law to deal with what happens if there's like a flood or a tornado that takes out electricity in a large part of the area, and we're dealing with election equipment that, well, we have the benefit of paper ballots. You know, the equipment that tallies the votes is all run on electricity. And what do we do in that situation if it's more than just one polling place? Another thing that we don't have a plan to deal with or statutes is epidemics, and that could be, you know, a bunch of election judges unable to serve at the polling place because of illness. But also, I know other states have looked at how to ensure that voters feel comfortable coming to the polling place if there is some sort of outbreak of the flu. And then finally, Secretary Simon did mention man-made disasters. That's physical disasters, but I also think there's been some interest in folks to look at technology as well. We have election night reporting running in our offices, and folks rely heavily on computers and technology and what would happen if we somehow didn't have access to that. So those are things I think that our laws don't currently address, and I know folks have expressed interest in looking at. And then I think mostly for the folks in the room that don't deal with elections, I did put together some quick numbers to give you an idea of the lift that happens on election day in the state. In 2014, which was a gubernatorial year, a non-presidential year, which is typically lower turnout, we had over 3,000 or around 3,000 physical polling places across the state. So those were set up running on election day. Making sure that all the work gets done, we had over 28,000 election judges working at those polling places on election day, and they served over 1.7 million voters. So, you know, that's all happening in most cases between 7 a.m. and 8 p.m. all on one day. And so that's a unique situation, I imagine, compared to the normal scenarios that you would end up looking at. I would also note that in a presidential year, you know, all those numbers generally tend to rise. Obviously, with voters, there's a much greater turnout. We had in 2012 just over 2.6 million voters show up in the polls on election day. Also, once the polls close, there's obviously election night reporting, tallying of the votes, and all that happens behind the scenes, but all that's happening on one day in the state. So the only other thing I'd mention, and I don't think it's in the PowerPoint, I apologize, but someone has suggested the task force also considering emergencies that happen outside of the state that affect Minnesota voters. With Hurricane Sandy, we had absentee voters that were unable to get their ballots on the East Coast because polling or not polling places, post offices were closed or mail was delayed. And we also had a lot of first responders and utility workers that at the last minute went out to the East Coast and had the same issues with the Postal Service that regular absentee voters did, but also had the added challenge of not necessarily having a mailbox to send a ballot to. So that's sort of my summary. As the Secretary said, I think we're working on getting someone from the Governor's office to come in and present on sort of generally the state's emergency authority beyond this election authority. But to the extent you have any questions on the three statutes, I would be happy to answer them.
I actually have one for either you or for Gary Poser. On the polling place location, who makes the call there? I see in the PowerPoint it says the local election official must approve any real location, but is that who makes that decision on just the location on the same?
I think it's technically the election judges themselves are in charge of the polling place on election day, and so I mean they would want to consult with their city clerk or if they could, but if they couldn't get a hold of the city clerk and it needed to be moved, the election judges should have the authority to move it.
Okay, under current law.
Under current law.
Okay. Any other questions or comments?
Can I just clarify on that,
yes,
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Stephen.
So, Mr. Poser, though, that is was that within the bounds of it has to be within a mile, and it has to be, then it would also have to be located, or the election would have to take place the following week?
This would be on the election day itself. So, say on November 4th, they got there was a fire overnight, and the polling place isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
The election, and hopefully the clerk knows about that. But the election judges could move it on that day, just moving the physical location of the building. They're not moving the date of the election itself.
And is there anything in statute that directs, or maybe in rulemaking that directs how you notify voters then?
Yeah, I think it just talks that they need to make, I think they are required to post a notice at the original location as to where they've moved to, and then the rest is just getting that word out as much as possible, but the only requirement is really putting a notice where people would be coming to or expecting to vote.
Thanks. Any other questions or comments?
If I could, one of the other things I think that could happen that we should think about is just if any of these emergencies, like specifically wiped out like voting equipment itself, and what would be the plan for replacing, you know, so if there is a flood and, you know, a particular city's 40 machines are gone, what is the plan to try and, you know, be able to count those ballots? We still would have paper ballots, but, you know, if the machines got destroyed within a week before the election, how would those votes actually get tallied or counted? You know, I know we have the paper ballots where, but I believe it was Houston a few years back had DREs and their entire warehouse burnt down and they had no voting equipment at all. And so that was a scramble to try and come up with equipment. And so I think it's something we should at least be thinking about if there's anything that could be done to mitigate or help resources for replacing equipment.
Okay. Any other thoughts, Senator Giffmeyer?
Yeah, I thank you, Mr. Chairman. I probably think, when I think of this, I think of a recent date change on a family get-together. And as soon as we tried to think of a change date, that meant one or two other people couldn't come. That could come on the original date. And we ended up saying, no matter what you do, that's going to kind of happen. So whenever you change those dates like that, we need to realize you will lose voters when you change location or when you change a date just by virtue of that. So it does not mean that everybody who could vote on that original election day or that location is going to automatically be able to when it is moved, and that is why so often everybody's very reluctant to do that, because you will lose voters, and that becomes an issue. So I just want to mention that just because you move the date doesn't mean you're automatically going to get all that again.
That's a great point. By the way, the scenario described sounds like planning this meeting. As many of you know from your emails, trying to get the date when everyone can come, and then you move it, and then two other people can't come. But that's the way things happen. I would add to that, Senator Kiffmeyer, and that's an excellent point. I would add to that in the little that we do have in Minnesota law right now, it's limited to discrete entities where the entire electorate is affected. In other words, the whole township, the whole school district changes its election. Now imagine a situation which I think will be called upon in future meetings to discuss. What if it's only part of the electorate? And there you might get turnout decreases, not because of people's schedules or convenience, but because the people will correctly mathematically conclude that their vote, you know, quote, won't make a difference. Imagine if in a, you know, governor's election, candidate A wins by 10 points and hundreds of thousands of votes, and in only one jurisdiction in Minnesota, there's a decision made to postpone. Some people might decide, well, why should I show up? The election's been decided. So what we have in law now is where it's all sort of self-contained. The entire electorate or none of the electorate gets postponed. But what we're called upon to decide is something I think a little trickier, as Senator Kiffmeyer suggests as well. Any other comments or questions at this point? Okay. I mean, I think it's safe to say there just aren't that many rules of the road right now in statute. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe others at the table with emergency management backgrounds and expertise could tell us whether, apart from what's on the law books, if practically speaking, and I don't mean to ambush anyone here, I'm just saying now or at future meetings could tell us whether, forget what's in the law books, is there any, from a practical standpoint, are there rules of the road that maybe we're not addressing in terms of election, whether in your experience or in your training, you've received, you know, instructions about whether, just as a matter, what as a matter of common sense you ought to do. I suspect that the answer, which is part of the reason we're here, is that the answer is not really, and that's why we have our work cut out for us. But at any point, others can feel free to interject about what they know in terms of elections being on everyone's radar screen. But unless there are any other comments on that or any other point, yes.
Mr. Chair, I assume that at some point in time we'll hear from counsel on the impact of Chapter 12, the General Emergency Management Statute, the governor's powers. That's a side issue that we'll...
Yes,
okay.
Absolutely. And I think,
Ms. Drellick. We did ask, the governor's office is planning on presenting on their Chapter 12 authority. I'm hoping it's at the next meeting, but I think we're working out schedules on that. But they will be here. I think that that's an important component, that even our office doesn't have a full handle on what exactly they have the authority to do if there's an emergency declared.
Any other comments or thoughts on this segment about what is or isn't in Minnesota law? Okay, well, with that, then, thank you, Ms. Rutherford. Why don't we move on to the next, or really the last presentation, which is from John Milhofer from NASS. And by the way, I should point out that though he is with the National Association of Secretaries of State out of Washington, D.C., he happens to live here in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So he's a great resource for us in more ways than one. So thank you very much, and pleased to have your testimony.
Good afternoon, and yes, I wish I could say that I came here all the way from Washington, D.C. to present to you, but since I work for NASS remotely from Minnesota, getting here from Shoreview was not such a challenge. But I worked very closely with our task force. I did a lot of the research and analysis and writing for the work product that you have in front of you and the coordination of that task force. So it works out really well that I was able to be here to hopefully provide some information that you find helpful, because a lot of the issues and questions I've already heard mentioned other states have addressed through contingency plans, through state laws. So I think there's definitely a lot of information out there that you don't necessarily need to reinvent the wheel. So our task force, the NASS Task Force on Emergency Preparedness for Elections, it was initiated in January of 2013. It was co-chaired by Secretary Denise Merrill of Connecticut and Secretary of State Tom Shetler of Louisiana. There were 24 members consisting of secretaries of state and election directors. And, you know, it kind of arose after, as was mentioned, Hurricane Sandy was approaching the east coast of the United States in 2012 before the presidential election. And there was uncertainty as to how this would impact that election. And though a lot of the fears didn't materialize necessarily in that situation, it created a lot of questions and concerns about what exactly do states do in emergency situations that have the potential to impact or disrupt an election. So that's kind of what we set out to do, was identify some of those policies, share information amongst those that had experience with those situations. And so through surveys that we did with election offices, research, conference calls with stakeholders at the state and federal level, and then meetings at our conferences, we drafted this report that has been distributed to all of you and tried to identify some of the kind of best practices and strategies. But the task force work was really in four kind of key areas. One was looking at laws and policies authorizing the postponement or suspension of an election in an emergency situation. Contingency plan, documented contingency plans and procedures. Procedures for displaced voters deployed emergency personnel that have been impacted by an emergency. And then looking at kind of state cooperation between election officials, emergency management officials, and then also the federal role. What type of assistance does the federal government provide to states in the event of an emergency impacting an election? So with starting with just I'll highlight kind of some of these areas, laws authorizing, postponing, or suspending an election. From the survey that we did, there were about a dozen states that indicated that they had some type of law for this. And in many cases, it was triggered by an emergency declaration by the governor. And then the actual decision to suspend or postpone the election was made by the governor, sometimes in conjunction with the chief election official, usually the secretary of state, or in some cases the chief election official has the authority in a few states to postpone an election. For example, Florida, if the governor declares an emergency, the governor either independently or upon request of the secretary of state or a chief election official in an impacted jurisdiction can postpone or suspend an election for up to 10 days. In Kentucky, in an emergency, and upon request by the Secretary of State, the governor can suspend or postpone for 35 days. And in Iowa, is a little bit different. The chief election official there, Secretary of State, does have the authority in Iowa to postpone an election in extreme inclement weather, natural disasters, and other disasters. And that authority can, with that authority, Secretary of State can postpone the election for up to 1 week, unless the postponing does not apply to elections with a federal office on the ballot. So Iowa's, again, does not require an emergency declaration by the governor. And a lot of states indicate that they didn't have a specific law, that they would just rely on court decisions or the broad emergency powers of the governor, which, as was mentioned, you'll be hearing more about, and to handle those situations where it necessitated the postponing or suspension of an election. So looking at the contingency plans, there were about a dozen states indicated that they had some type of plan, or some type of a state law requiring the development of a plan at the state or local level. And a lot of states indicated that they didn't have a specific requirement, but either the state election office provided advisory materials to local election offices, or it was up to the kind of the local election offices themselves to independently come up with plans. But looking at some of the plans that are out there, California passed a law in 2013 that required the Secretary of State to work with county officials to develop procedures for voting in an emergency. That plan had to be made available by December 31st of 2014, and that is out there now. Connecticut passed a law requiring the Secretary of State to develop municipalities in Connecticut administer elections, and they had to develop a contingency plan for municipalities. Municipalities were also required to develop a plan independently, but if they didn't, then they were required to adopt the model plan that the Secretary of State developed. And Florida, Iowa, and Kentucky all have administrative rules that kind of have specific procedures and guidance for election officials to follow in carrying out contingency plans. In many cases for suspended or postponed elections. And a lot of the plans vary in scope and detail, but some of the more comprehensive ones cover things like developing communication plans and contact lists. Connecticut's plan, you know, covers the need to make a contact list of vendors and personnel and law enforcement, emergency management officials, and having a way to actually carry out that contact plan in case people need to be reached. One of the things some states, you know, mentioned needing to utilize email and text message in case that landlines aren't available to smartphones. Another common, you know, area is informing voters of changes, if polling places changes or other procedures have to be changed, you know, whether relying on public service announcements or media postings at polling places, making sure people were aware of changes. Evacuation procedures and bomb threats and fires, relocating polling places and finding alternative locations. Dealing with poll worker shortages and replacement workers, and dealing with ballot security and security of machines, and that's addressed in Florida, Iowa, Kentucky, and then a model plan that Wisconsin had developed. Kind of look at some of the issues with securely transferring ballots, utilizing whether it's the National Guard or police or law enforcement. Ballots have to be transferred out of the polling place location. If machines need to be, how are they stored? How are they sealed? What happens with election results and certification? So a lot of the plans are out there address those issues. And including, for example, backup, whether it's backup paper ballots for electronic machines, backup rosters if you're using electronic poll books, and issues along those lines. And a lot of states just mentioned that in addition to contingency plans, they have other procedures for dealing with emergencies, such as some chief election officials have administrative authority to implement special voting procedures in certain situations. There are situations where polling place hours can be extended, where absentee ballot and other deadlines can be extended. And that kind of gets into, you know, Hurricane Sandy or Superstorm Sandy and the impact that had. I mean, again, it wasn't as bad as initially feared, but on the East Coast, there were 250 polling places that had to be relocated in New York and New Jersey. And in a lot of those states, Connecticut, Maryland, New York, Pennsylvania, Virginia, that were impacted, they relied on executive orders of the governor, in the case of New Jersey, the lieutenant governor, who was also the chief election official. But they relied on those executive orders to make changes in order to facilitate voting. For example, in New York and New Jersey, voters who were displaced from their polling place were allowed to vote a provisional ballot at any polling place location in the state. In Connecticut, the voter registration deadline was extended by 2 days. Maryland, New York, Pennsylvania, Virginia extended deadlines for requesting and submitting absentee ballots. Maryland allowed voters to receive a blank ballot electronically. And New Jersey actually allowed designated voters impacted by the emergency as overseas voters, which allowed them to take advantage of the state's laws pertaining to military and overseas voters, which allowed them to receive a ballot electronically and also submit the voted ballot returned by email electronically. And the big part of that wasn't just the change of procedures, but getting the information out to people about changes in polling places. So they relied on website information, public service announcements. New York created a 1-800 line for information on election changes. They utilized reverse 911 services, text messages for polling place updates, shuttle buses taking people from polling places that were not available to alternative locations. So that was a big part of that effort as well. And there are some states that do have specific laws for emergency for emergency workers, individuals who are deployed, have to leave their state or their jurisdiction to respond to an emergency out of state. So, for example, California just passed a law that allows emergency personnel who are deployed to request a mail ballot after the deadline and receive that ballot electronically. Louisiana passed a law recently requiring the Secretary of State to facilitate voting by emergency workers out of state, including through fax or other transmission methods. Oklahoma allows emergency workers now to that are deployed within 10 days of election to request an emergency ballot. Maine and Mississippi have extended their UOCA, their military and overseas voting provisions, to specifically include deployed emergency workers so they can take advantage of some of the procedures for absentee voting that would be available under those provisions. And Virginia and West Virginia have kind of general laws that authorize the Secretary of State or the chief election official to implement special voting procedures in emergency situations or disasters impacting the voting process. Those were kind of, you know, a lot of the things that we learned just based on looking at the experience and then what states have currently when it comes to out-of-state workers. But the next issue that we looked at was kind of state cooperation. We had discussions with the National Emergency Management Association and the Emergency Management Assistance Compact and the Florida Department of Emergency Management, and they all emphasized really cooperation and collaboration between state emergency managers and election officials. And I think it was mentioned earlier that, you know, when developing kind of a broad state plan, a lot of them mentioned the importance of making sure the potential for an election to be disrupted. It's important that it take into consideration that election officials have input on those broader state plans. But also, Virginia had an election contingency work group that met in 2012. This was even before Hurricane Sandy, but that discussed all kinds of issues with relevant agencies that could impact an election and developed kind of an action plan for how they would deal with those situations. Connecticut had a task force that was enacted. Florida has a task force that's automatically enacted among state agencies whenever an election is suspended or postponed. But again, it was really, it seemed like either again, ensuring that the election emergencies are taken into consideration and kind of static ongoing plans, but also if it appears that an election could be affected by a specific threat, then making sure that there was some type of plan for people to meet and gather and discuss the different roles and responsibilities and how what could be done to kind of facilitate the election. We also looked at the federal role, and over the past 20 years, there are only a few examples of the federal government providing assistance to states. One is in 1992, Hurricane Andrew disrupted the election in Dade County. The election had to be postponed, but the U.S. Army provided tents for polling places in that situation. In 2001, after the 9/11 attacks, municipal elections in New York's primary elections in New York City had to be postponed. And just because of kind of the chaos and having to reschedule those elections was very costly, and FEMA ended up reimbursing New York City $7.9 million for the cost of rescheduling that election. In New Orleans, Hurricane Katrina in 2006, municipal elections were postponed for 2 months, and FEMA reimbursed the city $733,000 for voting machines that were destroyed and flooding, although the state requested, I think, $2 or $3 million. And during Hurricane Sandy, New Jersey was considering using military trucks as polling places, but eventually, ultimately declined to do that. And we're talking with FEMA, federal assistance is available, but it's limited to situations where the president declares a disaster, an emergency. And when that happens, the assistance could include things like providing, helping states procure new voting equipment to replace voting equipment that was destroyed or reimbursing them for those costs, providing alternative polling place locations, providing access to generators and things like that. But again, that requires a declaration of an emergency or a disaster by the president. And FEMA also has online training tools that are available to the public and emergency managers that they encourage election officials, online training tools that they encourage them to utilize for learning about the handling emergency situation. And we also talked with the United States Postal Service just about some of the ballot forwarding services that they have, ballot tracking services, and they indicated that if and when there's an emergency impacting election, they increase the monitoring of election mail to ensure that things get where they need to be. So overall, based on all the things that the task force looked at, just outlining some of the effective strategies and based on a lot of the state plans that are in place, some of the things that planning and collaboration among state agencies was really one of the main keys. Assisting local jurisdictions in development of plans, really comprehensive communication plans, development of contact lists, identifying methods for informing voters impacted by emergencies, and looking at other state laws and policies and plans to see what might be useful for states that are considering implementing some type of plan on a state or local level. And a lot of the contingency plans and resources I mentioned are available on our NAS website. Has a task force page, and we have a lot of the contingency plans from Connecticut and California, the administrative rules from Florida and Kentucky and Iowa. And I think those will be very useful. I think, again, there are a lot of things that are discussed in those plans that could be adopted or at least incorporated into. Again, each state is obviously unique with regards to the administration of elections, but I would definitely recommend looking at those resources as you consider moving forward with any type of work product. And that's it. If there's any questions about
I have a couple.
Okay.
So, first of all, can you say, and I know that I've taken a look at the report now, a couple times, but generally speaking, just for the record, to what extent have you found that legislation is needed? Actual laws on the books, or is it a matter of other procedures that don't necessarily require passage of a law?
I mean, legislation needed for postponing or suspending or just anything related
just emergency
to
emergency management preparedness when it comes to elections. Is it easily quantifiable? I mean, to what extent should we be focusing on passing bills, mm-hmm. and to what extent do you think it's not that?
I think that's obviously something that has to be taken into consideration based, again, on the unique nature of elections in each state, based on kind of the discussions that go forward from here. But looking at other states, just some of the recent, like in California, the legislation there just required that the Secretary of State work with county officials to adopt kind of recommended procedures and practices. It didn't necessarily legislate a specific solution. Connecticut as well, developing a model contingency plan through legislation and then requiring municipalities to adopt that, but only if they didn't adopt their own plan. So I think it really kind of depends on, the unique character of administering elections and some of the types of realistic scenarios that are a threat. Looking at other states, Iowa has, as I mentioned, Iowa has legislation for potentially postponing, and they have kind of outlines of things to consider and contingency plans in their law. South Dakota also has a law. One is very ambiguous that allows that if the local jurisdiction is unable to administer an election because of an emergency situation, the chief of the Secretary of State can administer the election for that jurisdiction. The law is written very broadly, so I called the Secretary of State's office there yesterday and spoke to someone, and it was written for a very specific scenario, it sounds like, but how the law is interpreted could be a little bit complicated. So it's definitely something to look at to the extent there is legislation, making sure that it's written appropriately and specific to different situations. But one of the things with legislation is that it's very difficult to legislate for natural disasters, things that are so unpredictable. So even to the extent that states have administrative rules or contingency plans, they're very kind of broad guidelines, if you will, and procedures that allow the flexibility for the counties and the municipalities to adopt them to the unique nature of the unique circumstances. So, again, even though we found whether it was authorizing suspension or postponing or contingency plans, there were handfuls of states that had specific legislation. I guess what I would say is we didn't necessarily see states saying that it was really necessary. It just seemed like the states that didn't have legislation, being able to rely on executive powers of the governor, court decisions, and even states just coming up with contingency plans based on task forces that were held, that seemed to be sufficient in a lot of cases.
I have another question. I have a couple, but I won't ask all of them because I don't want to hog the microphone here, but let me just ask one more and then I'll let others ask. I'm interested in this question of who decides. And a number of what I got from your presentation was that in a number of states, it's the governor who declares an emergency, perhaps at the request of the Secretary of State or others. But really, the governor calls an emergency and then other processes kind of come into play. I guess my question is, in those states, if you can generalize, and maybe you can't, is it that the governor calls a statewide emergency, or the governor has the authority in those states to say in such and such county or these mm-hmm. three counties, I'm declaring an emergency, and postponing just there or in a congressional district or yeah. in – how does that work? Is it all or nothing? Is it a light switch on or off for the whole state, or is it more – narrowly tailored?
Yeah, I think some of the laws are relatively, again, ambiguous in how they're written, if it's just upon a declaration. I think a lot of them, some of them are specific actually to affected areas. So to the extent that the governor declares an emergency in an area impacted by some type of a disaster situation, then whatever suspension or, you know, it would apply to the specific area. So, again, to the extent that the governor issues some type of emergency declaration, if it's a statewide thing, then I imagine that any election impacted within that throughout the state, to the extent that an election needed to be suspended or postponed, then it would apply. But if it's just an emergency declaration specific to certain counties, then to the extent that an election in those counties was disrupted, then they could utilize those laws. But for example, Georgia's law allows the governor to suspend an election, or actually allows the if the governor declares a state of emergency in a certain area, the Secretary of State actually has the authority to suspend or postpone an election for 45 days in the area impacted. So some are more specific about it, but I think generally it applies to specific areas encompassed by the emergency declaration.
Okay. I have a couple other questions, but I want to hold off here and give others the chance to chime in with your own questions or comments. All right, I'll go for the next one while you're thinking of other questions. I have another question about Hurricane Sandy. I just want to make sure I understand it, or Superstorm Sandy. So despite some thought about postponing, none of the 250 polling places actually had a postponement. Did I hear that correctly?
There were polling places that were relocated. 250 polling places had to be relocated.
But no postponement of the election. Everyone voted on that Tuesday.
And I think in some cases, for example, I'm not sure, I can't remember the specific states, but some, again, deadlines were sometimes altered, whether voter registration deadlines and request deadlines. But the election day itself was not altered. There was no actually postponing of the process for the – although in some cases, I think there were a couple states where the deadline for returning absentee ballots was extended beyond election day, which is often done in a number of states for – there are several states that actually allow that for military and overseas voters, just as a matter of law. They have an additional time after the election to submit – and that some states also do apply that to domestic absentee voters as well.
Right. And some states have that rule – regardless,
right?
Every
exactly.
day they have an extra period after the election, whether regardless
exactly.
of an emergency.
Yeah.
Okay. So, so in connection with Sandy, or really generally, what about litigation in these instances? Were there any instances that you found or that you can remember where the law was unclear? Someone made a call, a governor, a local elections official, a secretary of state, and someone said, in essence, through the courts, that's not your decision to make.
Yeah.
The law is unclear, and we're suing. You have no right to make that decision. Or were the rules of the road clear enough so that they steered clear of the court?
You know, I think part of the issue that there isn't a lot of precedent. The good thing, I guess, is there isn't a lot of precedent or examples of elections being postponed. Again, I think to the extent that they are, they're probably things we don't hear about, township elections or smaller elections. But it's things that, you know, the things that we looked at where you're talking about larger elections, state general elections being impacted. There are not even really many examples of that happening. And to the extent that there are, for example, in New York City, I think it was, you know, the governor, after 9/11, the governor issued an executive order just basically postponing, stopping the election because it had already started taking place. People were voting when the attacks happened. The governor issued an executive order just stopping the election. Then I think the courts were relied upon to actually figure out the process for when the election would resume and postpone the election. But I don't really recall any instances of litigation really arguing some of how that process was carried out. Again, part of it might just be that, you know, there aren't a lot of examples in general of those of larger elections or high-profile elections being impacted.
Okay. Thanks. Senator Stephen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there, and I appreciate all this information. It's really helpful. In your experience, are there any states that have gone through something similar to this where they've really delved into the details of their state election law and come up with suggestions and then implemented those suggestions either by rulemaking or legislatively that we could look to? Because it seems like my perception is there's a lot of different things going on in different states. But are there any states that kind of
stand out from the crowd in terms of where we could look to start to process through some of these questions?
Yeah, I think if you're looking for kind of comprehensive plans that address procedures for emergency situations that are documented, that were based on some type of a legislative process or a task force-like initiative, again, Connecticut has a pretty comprehensive plan that addresses, again, a lot of things that came up today: development of contact lists, making a list of potential replacement. I know poll workers are hard enough to find as it is, but making a list of potential replacement poll workers that could be relied upon in case some people can't make it to the polls, developing a list of alternate polling locations just in case, so that has to be relied on because something becomes unavailable, arranging for transfer again of ballots and machines in case there's a temporary evacuation or permanent evacuation. So Connecticut's plan, again, California just came out with it. That was a process kind of similar to this. State legislation required that the counties and the Secretary of State work together to develop a contingency plan with procedures, and it was a pretty comprehensive plan that addresses issues. Again, none of them go into specific detail here, but they provide general guidelines and procedures and things that, some are more specific than others, but I think that's a good, that addresses things like health, if there's some type of a health epidemic, fires, a variety of different scenarios. So I think Connecticut and California have plans that definitely are useful to look at. Also, Florida and Kentucky and Iowa have an administrative rules, procedures to follow kind of an implementing contingency plans. And there it is a little bit more kind of, whereas the others are more here things to kind of consider. Those are kind of have a little bit more specific direction on how things should be handled in specific situations. So I think, again, Connecticut, California, Florida, Kentucky, and Iowa are definitely, I think you could probably find a lot of the answer, or at least the reference points to a lot of things that were brought up today just in some of those documents that are available.
Thank you.
Yeah. Senator Stephen, anything else? Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, I have one question.
Is there?
You had mentioned before that part of the discussion was with the Postal Service as well with regards to mail delivery and such. Are there any of the states that vote, like Alaska or Washington, that vote exclusively by mail? Do they have plans in place on how they're dealing with their issues?
Well, some of the states have plans. A lot of them indicate, in addition to contingencies, they have, business continuity of operations plans for state election offices. I don't recall Washington have kind of a specific contingency plan, but one of the things that they notice is because they're a state that votes mostly exclusively by mail, for voters who are displaced or emergency workers, they can actually get a replacement ballot online. So that was one of the things that they mentioned, that kind of their process inherently facilitates it, because again, if you don't get your mail ballot or you have to leave, you can just go online and print out a replacement ballot. So there's obviously voting by mail, really they don't rely on polling places there, so that I guess facilitates that quite a bit, or makes it a little bit easier than not having to worry about some of the scenarios.
Mr. Chair, I think that's a good thing we also need to keep in line, as we do see more precincts that move towards mail balloting. Minnesota does have some cities and townships that are voting by mail. It may be something that we want to keep in mind when we're looking at different options and things that we're thinking about as well.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's a growing number, about 50,000 or mm-hmm. so people vote in jurisdictions that don't have polling places, mm-hmm. where it is mail only in some townships and some cities. I have a question. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Kiffmeyer, I think you were first. Go ahead.
Well, I don't have a question. I just do want to say, though, that we jump to the specifics of how to handle them, but I think what provides the most court cases and issues like that are who has the authority and the definition of an emergency. Mm-hmm. I think those are the two stickiest things that will lead us into, after that, administratively, what are the process, procedures, and things that you do to handle all that. I agree with the flexibility. I think other states took a closer look at this as well and said it is not that easy. And I'm also reminded of New York, where I had the privilege of meeting with Mayor Giuliani and also the CIO of the city of New York after 9/11, and having a panel discussion about emergency things, and this was through technology. And he was asked how they prepared, and he said, well, we were preparing actually for a hurricane. We were more concerned about water. And he said it didn't enter our mind to think. And so we located our emergency thing in the fifth floor of the World Trade Tower, not knowing that we actually couldn't have chose a worse place, you might say, to have located our emergency management. And it was just totally a disaster. But he said what they found was equipment was replaceable. People were really important, and that it was all the discussions and exercises, and they kind of role-played different things about what would you do if. And he said that is what actually meant the most to us in the long run. And I thought it was an interesting analysis and fits in with what Mr. Milhofer has said here and other states have dealt with, trying to get down to a specific kind of thing and is nigh unto impossible, as unpredictable as they are. But I think the focus on the definition of an emergency, the authority, are really important. Who gets to say and what's the definition of that and the process for that? But I think some generic procedures in place for that could maybe be multiple options. And so for Mr. Milhofer, the question is, I couldn't tell for sure here, did they have anything in regards to definitions of emergencies, scope of emergency at all?
Yeah, I think the best example I can think of that is I would look to Iowa has administrative rule. In Iowa, if there's an emergency situation, there's a couple of things. Once there's some type of an emergency impacting an election, the county officials are required to work with the Secretary of State in that situation to develop a contingency plan for administering the election in that situation. And they have administrative rules that provide guidance and procedures kind of to follow in doing that. And then, of course, the Secretary of State also, again, has the authority there to postpone the election other than if there's not a federal office on the ballot. But they also, Iowa is probably the best example of a state that actually defines different types of disasters that they take the chance and try to define kind of what is considered an emergency for purpose of that law for, you know, extreme inclement weather, other types of natural, and I don't recall exactly what those definitions were, but I think that's probably the best example of actually defining the types of emergencies that would enact that those policies relevant to that.
It'd be good to get a copy of that, I think.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. I think that would be a great starting point, for sure. Yeah. I have a question just about where this fits in the mix. I mean, if it's truly just an emergency related just to the functioning of elections, say an equipment breakdown or a polling place burns down, we've heard examples of those offered today, that's one thing. But if it's part of a larger public emergency, whether it's a 9/11 situation or a health epidemic, I guess I'm wondering, and this is a very broad, sweeping question, I guess, but how do you get elections sort of on the radar screen? I would imagine that first responders, I would imagine that those who are, you know, experts in emergency planning, some of which we have here on this panel, some of their first concerns are going to be food, clothing, and shelter, and elections might be sort of down the list. Was that a challenge that you saw some states face? I'm not saying in actual situations, but in crafting their plans.
I think it's probably, you know, a challenge to the extent that there just, again, there aren't a lot of examples. So when people
right.
talk about it, it's like, okay, well, you know, when has that happened? But I think using Sandy, again, you know, there wasn't, that was one of the reasons we did this task force, is because when Sandy in the media, when Sandy came and was threatening a presidential election, I mean, the media was going crazy with what's going to happen if, you know, how are states going to handle this? What if Election Day doesn't happen? So those types of scenarios obviously, you know, draw awareness, and that's where we realized there was really a void, at least in an understanding what do states do, what policies are in place, what type of contingency plans do they have. So I think, you know, out of a lot of disasters, sometimes good things can come out of it, and that's probably one, is that it at least drew awareness to the need to have a task force like this, for NAS to have a task force to kind of share some of that, discuss and share the information. I think for the most part, it sounds like, you know, Florida is a state, obviously, that with the hurricanes that they have there, they have a very close working relationship with their emergency management office. But again, that's they run the risk quite often of very severe disasters there. But I think to the extent that states, you know, have developed working relationships, and just really, it doesn't necessarily, I think, have to be something where, you know, get into really detail, but just making sure that elections are on the radar. Again, if it comes to broader-based state planning, making sure that at least there's, it's taken into consideration the fact that elections can be disrupted, and also really maybe even having some type of process for, to the extent that as election day approaches, it looks like there could be some type of, having some type of a plan in place, a communications plan, or some type of a plan where people know who to contact and arrange some type of even impromptu meeting with the relevant stakeholders, because I think the situation probably to be avoided the most is really just being in a scenario where it's just, who do we call? Okay, we got to call this office, we got to call this, we got to call utility provider, what about backup generators, we got to call vendors for election machines. So really I think that's part of kind of an overall communication plans. But for the states, we thought Virginia had an election contingency working group that they developed with a lot of state agencies. Florida, Connecticut has a task force that kind of meets periodically on broader potential election emergency situations. I'm sorry, Connecticut does. So I think in those cases, I think people have worked, collaborated. And it was really the National Emergency Management Association, the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, which is kind of a mutual agreement among states to send emergency workers to other states in the event of some type of a disaster. They're the ones who really recommended to us that, you know, elections should have a seat at the table for planning. And the fact that when you're talking about emergency workers who are displaced, I think it's your emergency management offices that in a lot of cases will have information that can help you kind of contact and reach out and provide information to those workers who are deployed to other states. So,
thanks. Other comments? Yes.
I'm just a little curious on the federal election side and laws and how those authorities impact, or are there any authorities when you have a presidential election, congressional elections, is there actually any authority of a state to suspend or postpone ballots that carry that? Because, you know, many of our elections combine state and federal level elections. So I'm just kind of curious, how is that handled in other states, or is there no exemption? I kind of get the state side, and we've got, you know, the governor can declare a state of emergency and look at rules and authorities, and we do have some definitions in Chapter 12 for a disaster and emergency and some of those things broadly that gives governor a powers under those definitions to declare emergencies in the state, either statewide or geographically, typically by county. But how does that impact when there's a federal election on the ballot?
That's a million-dollar question. I think that was probably the toughest thing to look at. The Congressional Research Service put out a couple reports, I think, in 2004, really in response to questions that were asked after the 9/11 attacks. And it was very ambiguous as far as kind of what the federal role is, and when you're talking, especially when it comes to a presidential election. There really were no clear findings as far as how when you're talking about a federal election, exactly what the relevant law is on that. Now, what they did say is that there's really not a lot of examples. There's a few examples of, I think, congressional primary elections that have been postponed by courts, and there were really no issues with that. But I don't think there's any example of a general election with a federal office on the ballot since 1860, the Civil War, being postponed or suspended for any reason. So there really is, number one, it's one of those things, I hate to say Bush v. Gore, but unfortunately it's probably going to be one of those things, if it happens, that's where you'll have a mess on it. But what that report did kind of find was that, you know, they said that it kind of appeared that Congress has the authority to enact a federal statute for postponing election emergency situation, but that they also kind of said that, absent any type of federal law, that states would appear to have the authority based on court precedents to make those decisions for postponing elections. And again, to the extent that it has happened with, you know, congressional primaries or other things, there hasn't really been a lot of issues with that. But again, if you read those reports and your mind's not spinning afterwards, then I congratulate you, because you should get an award if you can make any sense out of it, because it's a very complicated topic. And unfortunately, again, especially when you're talking about the presidential elections and the the electoral college, it gets a little bit complicated. So, but those reports are out there in case you want to look and try to interpret what they're trying to say.
Although your NAS report, as I read it, said that your best, I'm paraphrasing, but your best guess was that states probably did have the authority.
Right, exactly. That they said that,
So even though Iowa has chosen
not
to do so in federal elections, that's not compelled by anyone. And that your best guess was states probably do have the authority, even if there is a federal office on the ballot.
Right, I think that's kind of, you know, that the federal government could, they think, okay, potentially this is just a very, you know, rudimentary kind of analysis. I mean, that, you know, that potentially that Congress could pass a law because they regulate federal elections, you know, postponing, you know, for some type of process, postponing an election in a disaster, but there is no law like that. In the absence of that, that based on precedents and court decisions, that states, to the extent that that has happened, so, for example, if a state has a law allowing the governor to postpone or suspend an election, to the extent there's a federal office on the ballot and to the extent that that has happened, there have, you know, it's it has, I think in 1992, maybe with the statewide primary, there may have been a federal office on that and a judge suspended that election in Dade County, Florida. But I don't think there has been a lot of, you know, a lot of examples or a lot of challenges to those situations. I think the real real complication comes in for potentially a presidential election and just, you know, you can imagine some of the scenarios if a state is, you know, a critical battleground state and for some reason, so I don't think we even want to think about that type of scenario. But it is something that, again, there has been a lot of analysis and just really just no clear consensus on how that would, you know, be handled.
And I think it raises a good point as we look at some of the committee work going forward, and part of that is, I think, focused on continuity. How do we manage the disaster in the event and ensure elections still take place? I think the law is kind of structured that local, smaller elections, for lack of a better term, there's more flexibility to postpone, delay to smaller electorate to reorganize and give them the opportunity to vote. As you get into larger elections, whether it's statewide or presidential, I think they become much more difficult to try to postpone because of the logistics of scheduling an impact. And so I think part of the work of the committee and working forward is on that continuity. And it looks like a lot of the other states that have done work have done a lot of work about the continuity. If A, B, and C happen, our plan is to go to D. And how do we ensure that voters can still try to vote on that day? And there are circumstances, certain things that will say that we can't. You know, it's not safe. We can have ice storms. We can have other things that impact. But it's those in Minnesota are typically going to be more smaller geographical based, unless we have the Halloween storm and the major part of the state and those kind of things. So I think it's a unique challenge to try to figure out and how we incorporate some of the emergency preparedness and planning to cross over to the election side. Because, you know, quite frankly, until I got appointed to come to the task force, I don't know that I connected the dot of election with our statewide disaster and emergency preparedness. I think if it happened on election day, it would click and we'd be working to figure that out. But I think there's a lot of things on continuity planning and polling places and alternate places and locations that can be looked at to try to deal with the geographical impact in an area that when it's not statewide or countywide, how we sustain that ability for people to be able to go and have those elections.
That's a great point. Any other questions or comments for Mr. Millhofer? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. We reserve the right to
Oh,
either call you back or call on you in some way because obviously you're very knowledgeable.
Yes, and if there's any of the plans I mentioned from the different states, I have access. And if there's any states in particular that you'd like to contact and like to you have any questions for, I'd be happy to facilitate those communications or anything like that. So just
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Yep.
You know, before we wrap up, I just wanted to solicit input on two points with the understanding, as I said, that some people like to do that in the meeting. Some people prefer to do that offline. That's fine. But I'll invite people either now or later to provide ideas for who you want to hear from, either now or later. What kinds of presentations do you think would be useful to you? We've already heard Senator Kiffmeyer think that's an excellent idea to have someone from a township, for example, who has postponed an election to talk about how that worked. So along the lines of Senator Kiffmeyer's suggestion, either at this moment or after the meeting, you know, to speak up or send an email about what you'd like to see or who you'd like to see or by category who you'd like to see come before us and provide us with information. And we'll work with the LCC to try to get that going. And we're open to any of your suggestions there. And then I want to revisit, too, the question I asked earlier, which is now that you've heard two presentations, both on Minnesota law or the absence of it and what other states have done, thanks to the work of NASS and Mr. Milhofer. What do you think about our tentative work plan between now and January? Again, either now or after the meeting in some form or fashion, I'm just inviting comment on that point. Is there anything you think we ought to reverse or change or anything we ought to add or subtract? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you. I think Mr. Lurie here really makes a point that I think we should give more consideration in our agenda, and that is the continuity preference, that continuity should come first rather than postpone or do anything else. Because I think if at all possible, the straightest way to do this is to continue. And I was taking a look at some of our on the meeting subjects that we had here, and also even from the NASS material, just in my quick reading, which wasn't thorough enough to really evaluate well. But I would like to hear more about the continuity and have it be more prominent in our work. What does continuity mean? How do you continue? And what are the parameters that you need to consider? So I think that continuity issue is well brought up and is something that should be strengthened, added. I don't know that it's not added, but more prominent.
That's a point very well taken, at least by me. I share that same preference, I guess I would say, for continuity over postponement where possible, especially where you have, you know, as you said, the bigger elections. That's a good way to put it. I think we want to avoid, where at all possible, the situation where one part of an electorate votes on election day and another part of the electorate votes a week later. It's one thing if you have a self-contained school district or where it's all or nothing, either all voters are postponed or none, but where you're dividing it, that's problematic. So that's my own feeling as well, Senator Kiffmeyer. I share that. Any other thoughts at this point about either who you'd like to hear from, either individually or by category, or kind of our tentative game plan? Mr. Lane.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think what I would like to understand is, you know, so if you are thinking in terms of continuity of operations, one of your first steps is to do a business process analysis. You want to figure out, you know, what exactly you need to happen and where the potential, you know, single points of failure, bottlenecks, dependencies on particular people doing things in particular time frames. I wonder if we could get a little of a primer just on what, you know, from the beginning to the end, from a technical side, what that business looks like from our colleagues across the way here. I think that would really help frame this, because I'm thinking in terms, just as I'm thinking back, you know, another potential problem here, it could be, you know, if your canvassing board has to meet within a particular time or within a particular geographic area, that's another potential point of failure that's going to interrupt the flow of, you know, really authority to govern from the electorate to the people who will be taking office. So if that's the process we're trying to protect, I want to make sure that we understand the process from one end to another so we can look at those potential points of failure. I think it'll give us a better sense of whether, you know, it's sufficient. I think the real question is, does the local government, does the governor, whoever's going to declare the emergency, have the authority to do what's necessary to fix the problem? If not, can we create that power? And that's one bucket of questions. The other is, you know, from a public policy standpoint, do we want to require them to exercise it in a particular way, which I think is a different conversation. But if it's a matter of creating power or clarifying the use of power, or putting checks and balances on it, for that matter. You know, you declare a local emergency. 3 days later, your local governing body is going to have to look at that and ratify it. You know, putting the ability to reschedule elections in the hands of individuals is something we might want to consider some checks and balances on, too. And is that sufficient? So if we could have a better sense of the process, that's what I'd like to hear that.
That is an excellent point. And I think we've got a actual physical divide here, actually, between, and I hope we can mix and match at the next meeting between the emergency management pros and experts and the elections pros and experts, and we hope to meld them, and hopefully you'll alternate next time. But that's a good point. In terms of the election side, I think next meeting it would be good, or even in advance of next meeting, to put together, and I think we can do that, some sort of timeline of, you know, how does an election process, what are the dates, what are the deadlines, what are the time frame, so that everyone understands what that process is. That's an excellent point. I know your comments went beyond just that, but that is one thing that I think would be very useful.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could, I mean, there are some instances where individual people are important. So if you're looking at pandemic planning, you're looking at, you know, disease. I mean, if everything's riding on one person holding particular decision-making capability, that delegation of authority, devolution, if you will, needs to be thought of as well. So, I mean, if only the mayor can do whatever it is, or only the city clerk, and it's the city clerk and not the city clerk or his or her delegee, I mean, that creates yet another potential bottleneck for that person being sick that day, and then you don't have the authority to exercise. So those are the kind of things I'd like to see just kind of pointed out. I think it would help the emergency managers give you better advice.
It would help all of us, I think. Senator Kipmeyer?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that brings up a good point, but I was thinking of, are we focusing around Election Day? And Election Day, it's really the precinct polling places where the action happens, and they have certain essential needs that they have. And I don't think there is, I think that out in the counties and cities and townships, there have been other kinds of emergencies, and they've had to be flexible, whether it's been location or equipment or people. Mm-hmm. They've had to do that already. But I think in that polling place on Election Day, to help give the context here, to give kind of a what happens specifically on Election Day and what is essential to that facility. I think for the emergency management folks, my brother's an emergency management guy. I was smiling because the language you were using sounds like my brother. So I just thought, okay, I get it better now. But I think specifically around the precinct. But then you're also talking about, right, a sequential chronology of what those dates are around the Election Day in particular. I just wanted to clarify.
And through the chair, I think what I'm looking for, I mean, I think the function, if we think of it functionally, what we want to do is preserve the ability for the electorate to transfer its power to its elected officials. So, I mean, really, that's the process that we're trying to make sure happens. I mean, that's really the bedrock on this is all built. So, you know, all the way from, you know, obviously the campaigns aren't going to be in this, but, I mean, all the way to the point where you need to be able to go in and cast your vote and have the physical ability to have that recorded to, you know, up until, I suppose, someone holding up their hand and taking their oath of office. I mean, it isn't over until they've done that. So, you know, there's a process that goes beyond casting a ballot that invests in anyone the ability to act on behalf of the public. And I think if we want to, and maybe it's just beyond the scope of what you're doing here. If it is, that's fine. Tell me to, you know, we've got to narrow it back. But that, to me, is the business process. How do we make sure that that vote turns into, you know, meaningful power at the other end of, because otherwise that person's been disenfranchised, right? Mm-hmm. So.
Appreciate that. Thank you. Any other thoughts presently on game plan or particular presenters or testifiers that you'd like to see? Understanding that tomorrow, next week, whenever, you can still email or call with these things. Anyone? Yes, sir. Major.
I got a couple observations. The academic discipline of emergency management is very specific. There's an academic discipline of continuity planning as well. And the terminology that's used and how it all fits together, if you're creating a unified field theory of emergency management or continuity planning, is very, very specific. But it's also somewhat underdeveloped in Minnesota. We have a brand new governor's executive order out specifically to continuity. We don't know exactly, or at least at my level, I don't know exactly how that fits within the Minnesota Emergency Operations Plan, and I'm sure Kevin's very busy on developing that sort of thing. I view the elections emergency planning as a subset of continuity planning. What does government do to plan for? Responsibility for that resting with the Secretary of State or with the governor, however that fits within Minnesota. Is there a need, we touched on earlier, is there a need for legislation to clearly define that? Is there the ability of the governor to clearly define that in an executive order? There's a lot of questions there. And just in order to summarize or in order to pull all these things together, I think it's important that we cross disciplines, we mix up. You alluded to that earlier, Mr. Chairman, on talking back and forth. I need to understand how elections are managed. I think your point's extremely valid to get that business process. How does it work? How do we get the vote from point A to point B? Senator Kipmeyer's point that there are different levels. We're looking in the military, we talk about the tactical level, the strategic level, operational level in between. And what level does this committee sit on? Is this committee tasked with providing specific guidance to jurisdictions? Is it tasked with overall thought or overall idea? And in order to come up with those directions, I think it's inherent that we share information back and forth, that we understand where you're coming from, and so on and so forth. And so I would encourage people to take a look at continuity of operations and continuity, how it's defined from a FEMA perspective and how it's defined within the state as it gets further defined.
Major, I would say from my standpoint, as just one member here, I think that certainly what we're and Senator Sieben is kind of the originator of this idea can tell us too, but I think certainly whether it's strategy versus tactics, I think certainly our charge here is the strategy piece, the big picture, who should decide under what circumstances, and we can be as tactical as we wish, I suppose, as much as we can develop consensus on. It may be that we decide, as Mr. Milhofer outlined, on the California approach, which is, yes, it's a law, but the law says go do a plan, and that's as detailed as we want to get. Or we can say, I suppose, one of our recommendations could be there should be a law, there should be a plan, and the plan has to have these things and include these people. So we can get as detailed, I suppose, as we want or as we can generate consensus for. But certainly I would say, you know, we're charged with the strategy piece and as tactical as we wish to be and as we can get consensus for. That's the way I look at it, but that may change over time as we go down the road.
And I would put that the devil being in the details, the closer you get to the polling place, the more complex the plan becomes. And with that in mind, my final question is just about the mechanics of the, I mean, who types the report? Who's taking notes? Are we distributing notes? Is that all on you? Is that general questions of that nature?
That's a great question. I think it will be a combination of the LCC and Ms. Olson, and then our office, too, will be providing that information with as much input as others care to provide in terms of logistics. So I think between the two offices, we can handle a lot of that. But if others have, before meetings, materials, for example, that you think ought to be included and passed out for the next meeting, or subjects that you wish to have discussed, just let us know about that. And my philosophy is, within reason, we should include that. We should err on the side of including, not excluding. So any other thoughts?
Yes. Again, yeah. And just, I guess, for some further enlightenment, I think one of the other challenges that we really have is recognizing the distribution of authority over elections and what the state actually has authority over versus, you know, the county being responsible for voter registration and for absentee voting, and for the cities and the townships being responsible for the polling places. That, you know, it's part of, from my perspective, of where there needs to be some good laws or procedures in place, because, you know, the secretary doesn't have the authority to say, county A, you will do this. It's like, that's not, that authority currently doesn't exist to do those types of things. So I think just recognizing that currently all of that authority is so distributed that can complicate our continuity.
And I think that's a good point on Mr. Lane's point. I think what we should have developed for everyone is not only timelines, dates, deadlines, and that kind of thing, but what you just said, Mr. Poser, which is, you know, currently under state law, who has what authority when it comes to just elections? Forget the emergency piece for a second. Just under elections, who has authority for what? Just so we're all on the same page. I think that would be just helpful for people to have. We may not even necessarily need to devote time at the next meeting to it, but at least have in people's packets so that they can have an understanding. So I'm committed to doing that for sure. Any other thoughts or comments at this point?
Mr. Chair, I would just suggest that this is a lot of information to digest, and it would be great. I would be sincerely grateful if some of this information we could get electronically prior to the meeting so that we can digest it instead of trying to read it while we're in session.
That's exactly the intention for the meeting
going forward.
Thank you. Yes. Good point. Any other thoughts, comments, suggestions? Senator Kiffmeyer?
Well, not quite sure where we're at necessarily on the agenda, but this is just kind of a practical thing of our
sure.
meeting time. And is 2 to 4 kind of a general meeting time that seems to work well for everyone, or was it just coincidental today?
I would say I think it was just coincidental. I think it was when we could get the most numbers of people so that we could have a quorum. I know we were having some difficulty for some time, but Ms. Rother, do you want to comment on that?
And Ms. Olson might be able to comment on it as well, but I believe the next meeting is scheduled from 2 to 4 as well, but we're looking at alternative times because 2 to 4 didn't meet with folks, I think, September going forward. Is that correct?
Yeah, so we might either be looking at a little bit September, the two dates that we suggested didn't work well for most of you. So we'll be coming out with some other dates for September. And going forward, October, November, December, we might just have to shift if those Tuesdays and Wednesday times work, just maybe shifting a little earlier to 1 to 3 because other people had conflict later in the afternoon.
For me, it's just plain rush hour traffic and the yeah. horrendous construction. It's taking me an hour and a half to an hour 45 minutes that would usually on a slow day take me an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And I know others are coming through kind of the same stuff.
Yep.
And not only that, at 4 o'clock, we have rush hour traffic on top of all that. So I'm just thinking, you know, it is specific more so to me, but, and if it's just me, I can work that all out. I do all the time. But if it is for others as well,
It is for me as well.
It is, okay.
Well, certainly if it were a morning meeting or something coming from the West, as you do.
Yeah.
The same thing. So, no, I think we're going to keep on trying to find the best time for the greatest number here, right. And we'll continue to do that. And you're right, we have to be sensitive to traffic as well and rush hour and those kinds of things, but that's a good point. Any other thoughts or comments at this point? Keeping in mind, you know, you can come back tomorrow or next week with other comments as well. Okay. With that, thank you, everyone, for your participation. I think we have a good tentative game plan, always subject to change. The meeting's adjourned.
Julie, can I leave this with you then?
Yes, that'd be great. Thank you.